This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Craig Langley Jr. and Count Isidore Fosco, along with my co-host Pilliter. We're going to be discussing the film The Crush, starring Alicia Silverstone. Great having you guys on.
Great to be on.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Long time first time guest, yeah.
Since both of you are first time guests, do you want to introduce yourself, Count Isidore Fosco? Go ahead.
Well, I work as an actor and audiovisual technician in Toronto. I've been a big fan of many old movies from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and longtime listener to your show. I really enjoyed the movie. I had not heard of The Crush before, but a lot of actors in here who I recognize, and it really took me back to some movies that I watched when I was a kid that my parents were really into.
Yeah, I remember seeing the commercials for when the movie came out in 93, and I know now looking back at it, it looks really dated, but that makes me feel kind of old.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm the baby here, but I mean, I think that, you know, this movie in particular is so much better than a lot of the other kind of psychological thrillers that we have been turning out in my generation.
Craig Langley Jr., do you want to introduce yourself really quick?
Yeah, thank you, Robert. I'm an aspiring filmmaker. I fell in love with the movies at 10 years old, or 9 years old, excuse me, when my parents took me to see the original Jurassic Park in the theater. And I went to film school. I later got a master's in writing, and now I'm just trying to work my way up. I got, you know, sidetracked in my 20s and for, you know, life and life, travel, politics, all the young radical stuff. Now I'm really dedicating myself back into film, and I actually loved this movie since I was a kid. It was one of those, my parents had cable, so it was one of those movies I'd stay up late at night and watch right after my parents went to bed, sneak in the living room, one of those many movies like that in the 90s. So I personally think it's an old classic. It's not the best movie, but I actually really enjoy it, so we can continue now.
Yeah, I remember seeing the commercials for it when it came out. I think I saw it for the first time when I was about 18, and then I've been watching it more recently again, just to kind of refresh things. Pilliter, and you also watched it recently, too.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I watched it. If I could ask Craig a question, what was the most chilling scene for you in this movie?
For me, it's actually the B scene in the house.
Okay.
With the girlfriend, Carrie Always' girlfriend, when Alicia Silverstone puts the bees against the vet and they go spurt. That always has freaked me out every time I watch it.
Mm.
What about you?
Well, for me, I really just love the scene where they're first going up into the attic and you see that painting. The painting of Alicia Silverstone, and it's just a freaky baby. I don't know if you noticed that, but I was like, okay, this is not going to end well.
I'm sorry, I have to be the boring, pedantic person, but I don't know, just for the listener's sake, should we explain the plot of the movie? Because we're talking about people going.
Let's explain the plot. So the basic plot of the movie is you have the main character, Nick. He's a journalist. He's around like maybe about 30. And it's filmed in Vancouver, Canada, like most movies are. But it takes place in Seattle. He's searching for a place to live, so he moves into the guest house. And there's a wealthy family living in there, and there's a couple, and they have this beautiful daughter, played by Alicia Silverstone, and he's in the guest house, and she comes on, and from the beginning, she's interested in him, and she's kind of flirtatious, and it's kind of like these films like Lolita, and but in reverse, because like she's the kind of girl that in real life you would have like all these stalkers going after, but then she chooses this guy to go after, and that's kind of how things start out, and then it's a psychological thriller, and it gets more and more crazy.
Yeah, I actually thought it was just a genuine crush when I first saw it, and I was watching it, and then as the plot progressed, I realized, oh boy, she's done this before. She's done this to at least one other guy before, and we eventually learn. But it was just there was really something about that scene in the room. I don't know how she knew he was in there. She must really pay attention to detail.
He was hiding out in her dressing room because she stole a picture of him as a kid with his grandfather, who was a famous journalist. He wanted it back. So he was sneaking into the room. He hid out in her dressing room. And she did like a little striptease for him, and obviously, I mean, she knew he was watching her, and she was kind of teasing him. And you see her nude from the backside, but I according to IMDb, they used a body double for that.
I was so disappointed when I found that out. But and actually, go back to what you're saying, Count. That I think that scene, you're saying it's better than most psychological thrillers. Say that scene is sexier than most sex scenes in movies today, which are so obvious and overdone and have no erotic thrill to it, if you will.
Mm.
Well, I think part of it is, like, these actresses today, they're just so vulgar in their sexuality. They're so crude. In this film, the girl, I mean, she obviously, I mean, there's the whole kind of psycho element, and she's psychotic, but she does have this like sweet, innocent charm to her at the same time, and that's also part is what is alluring that innocence, even though she is a psycho,
big time. you hit the nail on the head, Robert. It's they're not the viewers that haven't seen it. If you watch it, it's not vulgar like it would be today. Like there's no cliche scene of her running through the sprinkler in the front yard with the white t-shirt, although that would have been awesome at the time. But it's she plays it like the scene when they're in the dressing room or on the swing. There's a lot of scenes like that. That it's she's sexual with Nick Carey always, but it's not horse like get away from me, you thought.
Yeah, we were talking about this photographer, David Hamilton, on the show, and he passed away recently. I think he committed suicide, and he was controversial for his photographs. But in his photographs, there is something kind of innocent, like a traditional European aesthetic to them. And you see that in the film as well, like especially like the scene of her playing a piano. There is something kind of traditional about the film, kind of betrays of old school like waspy culture that doesn't really exist as much today.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm obviously born and raised in upstate New York, and that kind of family, innocent white neighborhood's pretty much gone. I mean, I grew up in a really white neighborhood, late 80s, early 90s, and that's really gone. I mean, my whole neighborhood now, I joked with my family once, oh, we got a lesbian couple now. The neighborhood's going to hell. So,
yeah, it's funny. I'm in a suburb, too. I'm at my parents' house, and our neighbors are Chinese. We got other people but mostly Asian. It's kind of like this whole invasion of just other races coming in. It seems to me that the white people, the normal WAS has been upper class, even the socioeconomics are going higher. I mean, certainly if we were to talk about politics referring to the crush comes from that time, especially in the 80s where you had Saved by the Bell or even Degrassi.
Yeah.
or some of these cheesy post 1950s but beginning of postmodern white people.
So do any of the Asians play piano in your neighborhoods and invite the neighbors over?
It's funny because you see Asians culturally appropriating white culture.
Oh yeah,
it's a little bit off topic, but I was reading something where college admissions committee suggested Asians not being too stereotypically Asian in their application papers, and they listed like playing piano, cello,
violin.
Playing tennis, but yeah, violin.
My one girlfriend used to do that. And she was a Chinese.
Have traditionally been like white things to do, and now Asians are sort of the only ones doing these like quote, white things.
Because I think all the white people married them.
Yeah, they're trying to continue this topic. Once again, here in my hometown, it's more diverse than it was when I was a kid. I joked at the local mall, that was the mall growing up. And now it's like the ghetto mall. But when you think of a ghetto mall, it turns black. But this mall has turned Asian, so I now refer to it as Asian Town. And like you were saying, Robert, it's funny, like, Asians appropriate the culture of white people in the sense, and then Hispanics appropriate the culture of black people when it comes to that kind of thing.
That's right. Too,
yeah.
That's so true, yeah. I mean, speaking of that,
something else I noticed about the movie, there's this other character in The Crush. She had an Asiatic name, Cheyenne.
Yeah.
Native American. Oh, her friend, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm mixing things up.
Amber Benson, who I think she was in Buffy, but she plays the friend of the Alicia Silverstone character, Adrian, and she's just kind of a normal, kind of shy, nice girl, but she's cute too, but she's actually the one who warns Nick that Adrian is really a psycho.
Right, and I got the impression she was almost lower class, though.
Yeah, so did I growing up.
Well, what's interesting, I was looking up her background. She's from Alabama, but her dad was Jewish, and her mom was a Southern Baptist. That's kind of an interesting background. But she was in Buffy.
Yeah, she played the lesbian girlfriend, if I remember.
I would say that's part of the movie, growing up now, that's one of the things rings true in my post-teenage years, because now they have at least with my sister and her friends, Cheyenne, and it's almost like that, what they would call now the Duff, that one kind of ugly plain friend that's friends with the more popular, hotter girl, and it's kind of like a abusive love-hate relationship into a sense. Like, everybody around teenage girls, there's always that one friend in the group that's not as good-looking as the others, and it's just kind of there.
Mm. Almost like we overlooked her.
Yeah. Well, she's cute. I mean, I wouldn't say she's plain looking. It just, obviously, if you can, I mean, any girl in comparison to Alicia Silverstone's going to look plain.
Yeah, and the movie just going to be made today in that sense. To go back, I'll finish up the last topic in the sense that if the movie was made today, Nick would obviously still be a white guy, and you'd have some, Adrian would play by some minority, like a black or Asian girl, and he'd be like stalking her, and it'd be a big racist thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I think the white on Asian would make more sense. In fact, I'm thinking of a movie back from 88. It was called Tokyo Pop with Carrie Hamilton, and there was this one Japanese guy in it. I think his name was... the thing was, I remember Tokyo Pop, and it gave me, when I saw The Crush, it gave me that vibe, but the vibe was basically a white woman... white girl falling in love with a Japanese man because she's going to Japan to look for love there. It has that very, like, it had that same film graininess to The Crush as into Tokyo Pop, but it was more on the Japanese side of things, and it was more like The Crush was, like, not psychotic, but, like, wanted to be a musician or something. But I don't know, some of those vibes of, because me and Robert talk about the vaporwave aesthetic.
Well,
being
it
like,
is, yeah, it is funny because the film came out in the early 90s, but the illustration, the movie poster is very vaporwave, where it shows sunglasses, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
anything associating also with Japan is also automatically vaporwave. But for the movie Tokyo Pop, even though if it's cheesy from 88, who cares? But then it's again, it's like a futuristic, okay, Robert, Asian Aryan people from Tokyo Pop is going to happen, you know? As we like to talk about.
And then there's a scene where she's in her bikini, and it's like one of those 80s style bikinis. It's like a one piece. It's pink, and it's the one of the ones where it's very revealing along the sides, and you see. I mean, it's a beautiful scene, but that still it does have kind of an 80s aesthetic. I like that scene, and she's just kind of lying there, and that one kind of reminds me. It's like Lolita too.
Yeah, and the sunglasses, you actually mentioned that goes back to the original Kubrick Lolita with the sunglasses.
Oh, yeah.
She's got the white bikini on, yeah.
Another thing that might be worth mentioning, the conversation between Alicia and Elliot earlier when she says people think she's a freak because she's too intelligent and she knows things. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, but I kind of thought that almost made me more suspicious of her when she's lying in her bikini later on, almost like she knows exactly what to do.
And you don't know if she's playing some kind of psychotic game with him or if she genuinely loves him. Just, it's kind of mysterious.
I thought it was deliberate psychopathy, like. I don't think I could have played it that well.
No.
Charles Lincoln just joined us. Charles, we're talking about the film The Crush with Alicia Silverstone.
Indeed.
Well, it's the Crush, right?
So, Charles, what was your take on the film? What was your favorite scene?
What's my favorite scene? I mean, I had never seen the movie before, and I thought that, you know, it's very realistic in a lot of ways. That's the main thing I'd say about it. It's a very real portrayal of how, a woman can trap a man and get a man into big trouble. The only possibly unrealistic thing about it, or at least atypical thing about it, was that, the girl ended up in a juvenile mental asylum. Instead of the guy ending up in jail, which would be the more typical and realistic result. No matter how many lies a girl tells, she's still got a lot more credibility with courts and police and indeed most people in society than a man does. And of course I see that all the time and it's very disturbing, but the whole entrapment business and faking by very clumsy antics, sexual assault and everything, that was all just totally realistic. And it happens all the time and all over America and probably, well, Canada and England too, and I'm not so sure about the continent. But it's a very typical story. And,
one thing that's important to point out is a film like that, I don't think it could have been made today. I think it would be a lot more controversial today, which kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier.
Well, you couldn't make it today for the women's because the feminists be like, oh my god, no woman actually acts like that. What a sexist movie this is.
Yeah.
Well, Robert and Craig, have you guys seen the movie Gone Girl?
Of course. Oh, excellent movie.
Yeah, it's a recent movie, and when I was watching The Crush, I was thinking that it's kind of in the same vein almost. Only it's not a young girl; it's a wife.
Mm. Oh, then there's a Fatal Attraction, which came out in the 80s.
Yeah,
I was saying that the guy with the glasses. Charles.
Gone Girl was just interesting because of the complexity of the lie involved, and the girl faking her own disappearance and death. I mean, that Gone Girl was really a much more complex and sophisticated plot than this one. I think that this one, are you familiar with Fatal Attraction, Basic Instinct, War of the Roses, those late 80s, early 90s movies?
I love War of the Roses, if only for Danny DeVito, not so much the fighting. Although that was pretty funny.
Danny DeVito as a sage, as a wise sage, is pretty unusual.
Yeah. Kind of the little Yoda for Valentine's Day.
I was about to.
In terms of women trying to destroy men's lives, basic instinct, really. Basic instinct and fatal attraction are very close to this one. You haven't seen those?
I remember them.
You know, Basic Instinct is famous for Sharon Stone's first major movie, Snapshot.
The Leg Cross.
Oh, yeah. Charles, you were talking about the first full frontal pussy shot, but the thing is, you're saying in a major Hollywood film, obviously, there's... But what about all those 70s art films with the... but you're saying not in film, but in a major Hollywood film?
A major release, general release Hollywood film, that was pretty much the first that I'm aware of. It was discussed as the first at the time, and everybody was very scandalized by it. I mean, the first time full nudity in a movie for a man was Last Tango in Paris, and that was just an awful movie. But one second of Marlon Brando naked was enough to make it, you know, immortal.
We were talking about the scene in the Crush where they use the body double where she's dressing, and I know there was that film Pretty Baby with Brooke Shields, and that's very controversial because of her age and because of the nudity. But I'm not sure. If that would be considered a major Hollywood, that would be considered a major Hollywood film, or is it more of an art film?
That's pretty major. That was pretty major. I mean, I can't. When did that come out exactly?
I think the late '70s. You have a film like Solo, but that's like an art film.
Oh yeah. Well, a recent major Hollywood movie that did something like that. Was, I don't know if you guys saw The Wolf of Wall Street, the scene where Margot Robbie first hooks up with Leonardo DiCaprio. She walks out the door fully frontal nude.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, times have changed a lot in the past 25 years. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying that in the early 90s, they were just, you know, the powers that be were just breaking down that taboo.
I was just a little kid, but I remember the controversy. I mean, in the early 90s, Basic Instinct was this big thing, and that scene was parodied by everybody, from The Simpsons to SNL.
you know, I was about to
There is this film with Bill Murray called Broken Flowers, and there's this actress, Alexis Desina. I mean, she was an adult when she made this, but the character... what I think was named like Lolita or Dolores, and it sort of implied that she's very young, and Bill Murray's sitting there on the couch, and he's like on his phone and he's all serious, and then just suddenly Alexis Desina comes in and like full frontal nudity, you see like pretty much everything.
Nudity films. Whatchamacallit? I was saying that the guy, the actor in the film, when I was rewatching The Crush, I couldn't help. But do you remember a movie called Trolls 2? There's this, or even Rick Moranis. It kind of reminds me of this geeky guy from that late 80s, early 90s type with the brawn and the glasses that just didn't mix on his face. Well, and it's just like an oddball character in a film where. His glasses, like, I'm laughing at him, and it's hard to take him seriously. Maybe because I'm out of the era, right? It's kind of like, I was in English class, right? And my one teacher said, we're going to watch Northern Exposure and learn about deconstruction. I'm like, for Christ's sake, it's Northern Exposure. It's so outdated and stupid, and you laugh at it, where it's like, you know, it's funny because now we can look at films like 20 or 30 years in advance. And I guess this is the reason why people say like the black and white films at the time were cheesy too, right? They said they were corny and authentic, not talking about the politics of today. Now we can kind of look at the 80s films and be like how goofy it is. And some people love that aesthetic, right? The whole vaporwave aesthetic or some of the humorous acting in it or something like that. But at the same time, there are definitely people who will take some of that aesthetic like, you know, Tron or Blade Runner or something in that zeitgeist that is definitely of interest. For The Crush, it's like this cheesy, like, the filming, right? That gets me. The graining and the characters and their clothing, and it's like this weird error, and it kind of goes with that film's aesthetic-wise. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's more, as I said, it's interesting to kind of, like, you have the vaporwave kind of 80s element, but I think it's more the early 90s grunge era, like you hear the the theme song in the beginning is early 90s rock, and then you hear that you see a lot of, like, leather jackets, and I think there's a scene where Alicia Silverstone's wearing those, like, short jean shorts. And you know what I mean? I'm actually, I even remember that look from when I was a little kid. I'm old enough to remember that.
Like, oh, I'm just looking at the movie again, and it's like his glasses are like, I don't know, if he was, I don't know, it seems like there was a joke when you call someone Four Eyes wearing glasses. And I think the glasses back then, even from George Bush Sr. wearing his big pedophile glasses, you make somebody, and he wears his big stupid four-eye glasses, and you point at him, and like, look at that dork. Now today, glasses are like sexy, right? Everyone has their like their black Waybearers or something like that. But the glasses
or you have the hipsters doing the glasses, it's like a nerd chic.
Exactly. And back then it was like, oh my god, look at this geek. And now when you see like this old film, it's like you it's like once again Trolls 2 when the kid goes, oh my god. It's just funny, you know.
Well, Count Fosco, you were telling me that the Nick Elliott character, he kind of represents like an old school, like a Anglo-Saxon masculinity, in the sense that his whole persona, but the amount of restraint he shows, I mean, that is truly remarkable how much restraint he shows.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, that would just never happen today. I mean, a 28-year-old giving an adult speech to a 16-year-old girl that's been hitting on him just wouldn't happen.
Oh, think of the scene where she bursts into the office party. She kisses him in front of everybody, and she slaps him in front of everybody. No man has the testicular fortitude to act like that today, if you will.
There's a really like
break down like a girl.
There's a Goonies style when he goes in the basement and he's like looking at his stuff. I don't know. I think like the Goonies for some odd reason or something, and he's looking at this crush thing.
Oh, the shrine?
Yeah. It's weird.
The shrine she builds, yeah.
It's a Goonies vibe I get from that.
But what's weird about the film is like she is so psycho, but at the same time, like the audience falls in love with her at the same time, like just like her whole facial expressions, her charm, just everything about her.
She's highly intelligent and she's very talented. And I mean, basically, what's not to love about her? I mean, she is.
Yeah.
You know, most women are psycho. What of it?
That's true. I was watching this interview she did with Jon Stewart, and I think like 94, and she must have been 17. I mean, this was the mid-90s, but she did have this feminine charm to her in the interview that you don't see in a lot of actors today. And that just shows how much the culture has changed in such a short period of time. Because in the mid-90s, I mean, I remember that I was like in elementary school.
And technology, too. Cigars, computer dosing, Doogie Howser looking phone recording, the technology too, right? A part of cyberpunk.
Cigars.
A part of cyberpunk, the whole mythos was that if Windows 95 and Apple II never updated, then you would have something like the future of Neuromancer. And I always think that's the cyberpunk. And they're flirting with that during the 80s, but that, it seems to me now it's post-cyberpunk. Cyberpunk never became real, and it's just like this strange thing.
When did the 90s and the 80s get blurred together? The thing is, like, I grew up in the 90s, but So I, like, fully remember the 90s. Pilliter, you're so young, so, like, you're blurring it all together.
Yeah.
It's yeah, like, really, man.
I mean, it's just, like, it's weird because today you have, like, social media, like, zeros. It was, like, MySpace and Facebook and, like, I was not a part of that. And now we have, like, phone apps. The phone era is, like, today, the teenage years. And it's, like, weird because it's weird how technology gets so rampant within the next 10 or some years to everything. And now what we knew as the 80s is basically should have been 100 years ago, which was only 30, 40 years. And from technology-wise, it's so strange.
While we were talking there, I was just kind of reflecting on just how subtle she is. It's like on the swing and she doesn't stop when told to stop. Right. Just that by itself is I don't know. It's a little groovy. Usually they would stop and almost become confrontational almost, but she's in control in her own way. And it is a very feminine kind of control. Another thing that I was just thinking about, that scene with the father, in the attic where, he threatens to, crush his balls with a wrench.
Oh yeah.
Maybe that was actually the scariest scene because he looked like he meant it for a flash of a second. That would be the one thing that might make a modern man think twice.
Well, most girls don't have a father today, so.
I mean, that's, yeah. Well, it's weird because it sounds like the 80s sounded like more or less a safer, except for the psychotic part, you know, she's psychotic, but it seems like the 80s was much more of a safer time period, or at least that there was this post 1950s America going on, at least from the multiculturalism
it's
chaos.
It's the 90s!
Today.
Stop getting them confused!
No, I'm saying this from the 80s. I'm not getting it confused, I'm making a progression here, right? So, like, in the 80s, you had that, and then in the 90s, Robert, there was this, you know, the whole white privilege came about, right? This whole ideal that you were getting in the positions of power, and this whole, like, the electronic music and whatnot, but, you know, compared to the Crush. Because if you think about it, it's like so close to the 80 period. Like within the periods between, you know, turn of the decade, there is that subtle cultural experience. Like, for example, Depeche Mode's Violator came out in 89. Everyone said that's quintessential 80s. The next album came out in 93, and that was Songs of Faith and Devotion. Totally a rock-oriented album. Like, that's not Depeche Mode. Yes, according it was, and people says it's a early classic Depeche Mode, even though you could say that's a 90s, even though that was the gap between those two albums was literally a cultural shift. And from 89 to 93, there is definitely something in the change of the culturals. But it, once again, I said it's how much has changed by technology within a 2-year period. Now it seems like every 2 years, it seems like we're going in the future by 20 years.
I just wanted to interrupt for a minute. I mean, you mentioned a few seconds ago about the scene where Dad is threatening to cut off his balls. You really found that scary? He's smiling. He's laughing. He's making a joke out of it. And Nick doesn't look scared at all. I mean, he pays attention, but I don't think that was a scary scene. I think that traditionally fathers would have been much sterner and. It would have said, really, if that would scare you, then I think, you know, you've never really met a real old-fashioned father.
Well, yeah, most of our fathers on TV tend to be more Homer Simpson types. I was just remarking on the difference.
A lot of guys kind of have their kind of, like, ideal girl. Some guys kind of like the kind of generic blonde, big-breasted blonde types, like Pamela Anderson. Some guys like maybe like Monica Bellucci. There's guys who are into like Rihanna and Beyonce. Then there's guys who are into the whole like Asian thing. But I guess I kind of want to get your thoughts on what you think about the concept of kind of like how different guys have like their ideal type.
Oh boy.
Oh, where to begin?
Robert, you want to go first?
I think that's pretty obvious.
Oh. Well, if you case, Robert loves blonde Jewish women. Just putting it out there. Alicia Silverstone. And
I still don't think that that's a type, though. I mean, if you compare Alicia Silverstone with Amber Benson and Sarah Michelle Gellar, there's a lot of variety in there. There's a lot of variety.
Sarah
in there.
Silverman?
I wouldn't put Sarah Silverman in the same category.
Because she has
blood. No, did I say Sarah Silverman? I said Alicia Silverstone. Sarah Michelle Gellar, I said.
Yeah.
Sarah Michelle Gellar. I did. Sarah Silverman's not blonde or attractive as far as that goes. No. She's sort of monstrous to my mind, but
she's got an ad in one Israeli magazine where she's like, "Holy sheets," and she's got like a hole through her bra, like you're gonna tit fuck her or something. But whatever. That's up to someone's preference where you find Silverman attractive. But
if I can cut in here, I would say though, I think one thing that's very interesting about our culture, has, like Robert was saying about men's different preferences, is how, like, Alicia Silverstone's very feminine, cutesy girl next door. Now, I'm not talking about the psycho part. I'm just talking about that type of girl is still somehow surviving in our multicultural, darkening, racial country with the fact that Taylor Swift is still so beloved by so many men, and she's that old-fashioned throwaway girl
Nazi
next door,
Barbie.
Sweet girl to... Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Like the whole, like, alt-right meme, like the Aryan goddess.
Yeah, Camille Paglia.
Camille
Paglia called Taylor Swift Nazi Barbie, you know?
I would actually fall into more Robert's category. I guess my taste in women is more kind of like just straight up Dutch, Cro-Magnon looking Nordics. I never really kind of I wasn't really that interested in the Buffy look, but I definitely prefer it to the Beyonce look. Let's say that.
Let me tell you something.
I think there is such a thing as too big.
I guess I'll tell. Yeah. Robert's been asking me what an ideal woman for me is. I got two girls. One girl I've been telling was Sabina Altabenkova. She is basically a volleyball for the Kazakhstan team, and she's basically Kazakhstanian, right? But she does have like Asianic features in herself, and she's almost passed as like Japanese or whatever. But technically, she is considered Central Asian or European, right? The thing is, you know, she's 20 years old, still young. Look at any of Altabenkova's pictures, and she's so pretty. But if you want to know something, guys, I actually met this one actress named Madison Hu in real life. And we were talking at a dinner party, and she said, "Oh, I'm an actress too." "Oh, really? That's really..." "I'm in this one show, and it's called Bizarrevark." I'm like, "What's that?" And now what's funny is that this girl I was flirting with, I now see on the TV on this children's show called Bizarrevark. And she's basically the only Asian girl in there, Chinese girl. And I'm like, but she's like 15, though. She's like, and it's like, we're kind of, I'm so, technically when she's legal, I can, you know, maybe pursue her. But the thing is, like, wow, it's like she's on this Disney Channel and like this close to like getting her to be my girlfriend.
Yeah.
But then again,
you
it's like,
your paycheck, man.
I don't know. But
what's kind of funny about the crush is like she was like 15 in the film, but then I was like 7 years old when it came out. So that's kind of a weird dynamic.
Yeah, I was 11 when it came out. But to go back to the last, it's interesting you mentioned the ideal type. Maybe it's why I lost my virginity to a Jewish girl. I'll just admit that out loud.
I lost my virginity to a Chinese girl, but go ahead.
There you go. You mentioned Buffy. I actually don't like Sarah Michelle Gellar as a blonde. I thought she was dropped a good. I loved her with her dark hair and Cruel Intentions. Have you ever seen that film?
Oh, yeah, I love that film.
I actually love her in that, so...
What's interesting is, I mean, Sarah Michelle Gellar is gorgeous, but she has a more, I guess she has a more kind of a hardened look. She doesn't have the kind of, she's not as cute as Alicia Silverstone, but she's definitely gorgeous.
No, if you go back,
they're just different, Robert. I don't know how you can really say that she's not cuter. I mean, I think that they're totally equal. It's just that one is sort of round and soft, and the other is much thinner and
You know, it only just and shaped just shaped differently. They're shaped differently. But I think Sarah Michelle Gellar is absolutely, positively beautiful. I mean, how about how about American Beauty?
Absolutely.
How about American Beauty? Mena Suvari. What do you think of her? She's basically my idea of that.
Yeah, she's gorgeous. I think she's Estonian.
Yeah,
she's Estonian. She is Estonian.
I read these white nationalist blogs, and they say, oh, these women, they're only attracted because of their European genes.
Yes.
And, like, we don't want them, like, dirtying our gene pool.
Oh, yeah, but they said they like Alicia Silverstone. They're like, oh, I found out she was Jewish. It's so tough.
And then it's like they're guilty because they're like, oh, boy, did I jerk off to her? I can't believe I jerked off to a Jewess.
Yes. It's retarded.
Well, I mean, don't you think that I thought that was kind of an interesting aspect of, you know, Robert's focus on this issue for this time in history, because I think a lot of white nationalists right now are probably really wondering what is going on, because, you know, just in the broader political social context, white nationalists all got behind Trump, and all Trump is doing is really building up Jewish power right now. I mean, right? I mean, am I wrong? I mean, he's building up Israel. He's building up. He's got a lot of Jewish appointees. It seems to me that, you know, some people have called him the most Jewish president ever, and he's got a Jewish family, an actually active, not formally Jewish, not ancestrally Jewish, but currently practicing Jewish family.
Yeah.
So and yet every, you know, Kevin McDonald, William Johnson, you know, Mark Weber, everybody, Eva Leon, right? Well, Eva Leon was a little bit iffy, but, you know, everybody on the in the far right was saying we got to get behind Trump, and you know, how are they feeling right now? I mean, probably much like the guy you're talking about who didn't like having to admit that he jerked off to a Jew. I mean,
well, can I interject here?
Sure, go ahead.
What I would say is I've been in these circles for 10 years, and I would say that crowd you're talking about, I think that's more the Stormfront type crowd is kind of dying off, and they're being more replaced by what I would call the alt-right crowd. I mean, that old Stormfront crowd, let's face it, they kind of ate themselves up with that whole TLS controversy when they found out Mike Enoch's wife was Jewish. And that was kind of their final blow. And I think more of the Richard Spencer alt-right crowd is taking over. And that old Stormfront, Don Black
just
crowd
remember,
is kind of going
away. Richard Spencer
Richard
was
Spencer
bad.
Was saying, Heil Trump.
No,
Richard saying,
Richard Spencer was
by leading people to say,
yeah,
Heil Trump.
But the thing about Richard Spencer is, like, you have, like, the people there doing the Heil Trump, but then he also has, like, Jewish speakers, and you have Tila Tequila there, too.
He was banging Asian chicks in his 20s, so I'm on his
side.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I completely agree with him 100%. White nationalists need to bang Asian chicks.
Count Fosco, do you want to comment on the unique appeal of these women?
You mean Alicia or some of the other women we've been talking about?
Both,
well,
in general.
I don't think she looks Anglo-Saxon. I'm not trolling you there. I would
her
put
mom,
her.
I think her mom was Scottish.
Scottish, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't place her as Scottish. I'd put her somewhere in Central Europe, maybe Ukraine. That's just my best guess.
Central Ukraine is in Central Europe?
Well, no either Central Europe or Ukraine, somewhere between there.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't think her as being particularly Anglo-Saxon. Well, I mean, like, if her father was Jewish, it kind of reminds me of Tony Curtis and what's her name?
Janet Leigh,
yeah. And, of course, their daughter also, Jamie Lee Curtis. It's kind of the same kind of coupling.
Count Fosco, you were saying kind of Central Europe. You mean like Bavaria,
like,
Austria?
Like Czechoslovakia. Yeah, like Czechoslovakia, Bavaria, Austria, that area. I'd place her somewhere around there, or I'd put her in Western Ukraine, somewhere around there.
Yeah,
Have you been to those countries? Like, or you're just kind of going off of what?
I'm just going on, like, the pictures I've seen of women from those countries.
I will back him up on that, because I spent the last two summers in Prague, in Czech Republic, and that girl does look like the kind of Czech girls there.
She's got a really piggy nose. Sorry about that, Robert, but I don't know if you find a pig nose sexy, but some people get turned on by that. Noses are very of a... I mean, once again, I tell this to Robert. I was good friends with a blonde Jewish girl who worked at Hooters in my race and Judaism class a few years ago, and she was super nice, and we were flirting and texting, and like, hey, I mean, she does look like this picture in there, and she was a nice girl, and though I didn't want to, I don't know, we were good friends and study buddies, but hey, I don't know, she would talk me, whatever.
I'm just interested. There was a race in Judaism class. I want to hear about that class. Was taught in that class?
It was taught by a rabbi, and he basically fills the credential of a diversity class. And he basically talked about how Jews are an important center of the culture wars in America and helped give us multicultural and diversity. And Jews are always good to have discussions, support Israel, PC stuff like that. And then he talks about the culture of critique, why that's bad, why Christian Lander stuff white people like is bad. But then it's like, then he'll flirt with, like, Norman Finkelstein and be like, then talk about that one documentary, Defamation by Yoshimi.
I interviewed that guy.
We talked about that film in our class, and it was pretty cool. But,
interesting.
Yeah, it's
You know what's interesting is, I interviewed that guy, that documentary filmmaker from Israel. I mean, I did a more of a highbrow kind of old school VR interview.
Yeah.
But those girls in it were pretty hot.
Oh yeah, yeah, they were. Robert, I'll go on this too. I mean, like, girls from Israel, you know, they're surprising because they just look like normal white Americans. But when it turns out that when they came into Israel, they have like some of them are more European Ashkenazi blooded, and they definitely do have this strange. It's not like a Middle Eastern flair. It's a very Western flair. I mean, if you find that Israeli mix important, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think about it in those terms. I'm just not I don't know, but I know you like Jewish things, Robert, so.
Okay, that other actress I posted, I think her name is Halston Sage. She looks very Eastern European. Craig Langley, what do you think?
I think so. Yeah, like I said, I was in Prague, and looks just like them.
Looks the girl like I posted.
Yeah, looks like a lot of Czech girls I ran into in Prague.
It's really, like,
I would bang.
What were you doing in Prague, just for curiosity's sake? Did you go school there?
Kind of. What I was doing is, since we're talking about film, it's kind of interesting. I'm an aspiring filmmaker, like I said at the beginning of the show. And I was actually being taught for two summers as an internship to learn screenwriting under James Reagan, who was one of the writers of The Deer Hunter.
Hmm.
So okay. I was learning how to write screenplays, and they ended up writing screenplays for studios by one of the writers of The Deer Hunter.
Since we're on the topic of screenplays, I'm working on a novel, and Alicia Silverstone character in The Crush, she was kind of the inspiration for the romantic lead, the romantic love interest in my novel. But in my novel, she's not really the psycho. The male character is more the stalker. And I just kind of have her as just kind of, she's very mysterious.
You mean he's like Elliot Rodgers, the stalker? Or...
yeah, kind of. If you
a Jewish version of him? A Jewish version of Elliot Rodgers?
But he's obsessed with blondes like Elliot Rodgers, just a more particular type of blonde.
I know. Right?
Well, I don't know.
Spoiler alert.
Is your name of the novel Supreme Gentleman?
Yeah, it's Aristocrat.
No, it's not. Let's just keep our audiences in suspense. All I'm right. Still working.
Oh, I want to ask, speaking of another.
I don't know if Elliot Rodgers actually stalked anyone, did he? I mean, he mostly just got pissed off that people wouldn't give him the time of day and decided to take revenge.
He stabbed his roommates and shot three, four blonde girls or something like that.
Yeah, he was obsessed with this girl named Monette Muo, who he went to high school with. And I remember when Greg Johnson did that his Elliot Rodgers podcast. He said, I was watching coverage of the Southern California, and I heard Elliot Rodgers talking about a lot of blondes.
You better talk that to Greg.
was that there were a lot of blonde Jewesses.
What was that?
It was a podcast. And Greg Johnson said something about blonde Jewesses, which Robert needs to talk to Greg in person about.
Well, it's a definite irony, right?
But, I mean, Greg is obviously a lot more anti-Semitic than I am, and he's coming at it more, I think, from an anti-Semitic angle. But I kind of get where he's coming from, because what's basically happened in Southern California is the traditional Anglo-Nordic stock has been totally dispossessed. So what's basically left over in kind of the elite of Southern California is like these like blonde, mixed Nordic Jewish girls are like the most attractive.
Robert, I've got to object to you saying blonde Nordic Jewish. I mean, Nordic and Jewish are just two different things. You can't have Nordic Jews. I mean, it's just, you can definitely have Central European Jews. You can have, German and English Jews. But Nordic Jews is sort of an oxymoron. You can't mix those two.
It's basically like, I know where Robert's coming from, and especially everywhere else in major cities. I mean, especially on the California, it's all Asians, right? It's all white male, Asian female, right? And it's just like,
and
this...
what's also interesting was, yeah, what's interesting is the crush was filmed in Vancouver, Canada. And today, Vancouver, Canada, it's like a pretty much almost majority Chinese, but you don't see a single Chinese person in the film.
Yeah.
Well, in 1992, it wasn't. I mean, I've been going to Vancouver my whole life, and in 1992, that was basically before Hong Kong finally closed down, and it was only when Hong Kong finally closed down and was going to close down that this huge influx came in. In 92, it was still a white Anglo city. I mean, it's amazing what happened. The Canadians are much more racially suicidal than the Americans. The Canadians they've got us beat way to hell and gone.
Yeah.
I mean, they just invited everybody in, and I mean, I cannot believe what happened to Vancouver. I mean, last time I was there, yeah, I mean, even the West End of Vancouver, I mean, the Anglo population is basically aging and dying
yeah,
out.
Again,
people who left it.
I bring in William Gibson. He's from Vancouver. He wrote Neuromancer. It's as if he's almost fetishizing and in love with this whole dystopian Blade Runner thing society, right? There's some whites out there who like fetishize in their own doom when it's just like, nah, that's kind of bad. It's weird.
Well, back to the film The Crush, if you analyze the dynamics, the only non-white person in the film was the black cop who arrests Nick. And then basically you have all white people. The main character, Nick Elliott, he's played by a British actor. Then all three of the leading female roles, Alicia Silverstone, Amber Benson, and I forget the other actress's name who plays his girlfriend. I think Jennifer Rubin. They're either Jewish or half Jewish. But there's basically no diversity, and hardly any diversity in the film. It's basically, it shows a society that's very homogenous.
Yeah. Oh, Robert, I wanted to ask you this question to play off that last point, if I can. I'm just in the last couple of years, I was introduced to it by Matt Parrott, is the whole vaporwave thing. Now, what you were saying, with the whole vaporwave, early 90s, 80s, this kind of whole thing, could that be like an unconscious or conscious attempt
Yes.
by many people to cry, hark back to a white America
Yes.
when it was still white?
Or even for that matter,
you know what?
It could be Asian.
I think that's... Yeah, Pilliter said that there's definitely a Japanese influence in vaporwave.
Here's the thing,
but I do think that's one of the reasons why there's so much 80s nostalgia, and
it's a division between Fashwave and Italo. Really, it's like Richard Spencer reappropriating it to be like, oh, it's Roman Bus, it's new Fashwave white people, and then the vaporwave Japanese Macintosh plus Asian Aryan stuff. So really, it just divided into two different lanes. So.
Well, basically, if you look at subcultures, the 80s was the last time when basically the subculture was super white. Then you had grunge in the early 90s. You had hip hop. Then you have the hipster culture is very kind of Swipple, but it's also very lefty. People having tattoos, really into kind of diversity. I mean, the kind of obviously there's fash wave. Then there's a kind of a new retro wave artist. The mainstream ones who would disown obviously fash wave, they wouldn't want anything to do with it. And I kind of get that. But it is kind of I do see it as a kind of new subculture that is futuristic, but there is an implicit kind of whiteness to it, definitely, even though there's also the kind of Asian element to it as well, which applies to Pilliter's theory.
No, I agree. The 90s were very black. I mean, I was 17 when the 90s ended. Like, the 80s were very white. In the early 90s were very white, but then in the mid-90s, it became very black. What I mean by that is, like, that's when what we think of today as rap really took the fuck off.
Yes.
It's like N.W.A.,
Race
War. It shows, like, the Wayans brothers and Martin and Will Smith became a star. The last years of the 90s were really fucking black in pop culture.
I think it, like,
yeah,
industrial
I remember
music.
That, especially the entire era from when I was in middle school and high school, you had, like, Destiny's Child, Beyonce, right around that time, especially.
New Jack Swing, all that happy black people music, but you also had, like, the weird, angry white people electronic music, like KMFDM, yeah. The Atari Teenage Riot, and some
stuff. Oh, my God, yeah.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the film, The Crush, that we didn't touch on?
I like The Crush. I think it's a very aesthetically pleasing film. Spaces between the aesthetic. We can now look at it as something that could motivate. And maybe for the psychotic part, too, there's definitely a theme in about that between psychotic women. You could probably put that in the whole maybe feminist criticism or big towel. I don't know. But
there's
a lot you could take from that theme-wise. But for aesthetic-wise, I'm talking, is definitely an interesting movie and gives me feels for some respect.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, one thing I would say about the movie, though, there's another reason the movie couldn't be made today. And I've had this conversation with people. If you look at the whole 90s genre, that really isn't the 90s genre with Basic Instinct, Jade, and maybe even even a little bit Cruel Intentions, or definitely Wild Things. You ever see Wild Things? The whole erotic thriller, which really died in the 2000s with the ubiquitous growth of porn everywhere. Like, we really don't have erotic thrillers anymore because...
I'm writing an erotic thriller, but it's a novel.
Yeah, but that kind of movie's not made anymore.
No, it's not.
Like, the audience.
It's because more like 50 Shades of Grey, but I don't know. That seems...
Well, that's just a fat girl fantasy. That doesn't count.
Charles, do you want to talk about your personal connection to that, or you'd rather keep that undisclosed?
It's kind of a matter of public record, but I was married to the real Elena Lincoln.
Really? Wow.
Yes. Yes, I was. I was married to the real thing, who met the author at an opera, Wagnerian opera, as a matter of fact, in Seattle some years ago. I don't know if you know, the Seattle Opera does a ring cycle every couple of years.
Oh, okay.
And, that's all kind of, yeah, stranger than fiction, but yeah. But she's my ex-wife, not my actual wife.
I think one more thing I'll say about the film is that it is a tragic love story because... you kind of have these moments, like there's the moment where they're together looking over the waterfront, and even with all this psychotic element, there is this kind of magical romantic moment. And then it ends with her in the mental institution, and then he goes on in his life and moves on, and like kind of a part of you...
It came out the same year as Basic Instinct.
Do you really think that Basic Instinct was a tragic romance? I mean, come on.
Well, I haven't seen Basic Instinct.
Well,
then you're not looking at the correct. It's the same year. You know, within a couple of months, these movies came out. These movies came out, and I mean,
wish that maybe there's a sequel where she's 18, she's legal, she goes off to college, and then he becomes like a college professor, and it's still kind of a controversial, but it's legal, and then they fall in love and have this beautiful family with like five kids and a beautiful house. Like, part of you kind of wishes for that to happen.
Well, I one thing I will point out, though, is you mentioned the ending, and you missed the most important part of the ending. And this, I think this makes what, I'm sorry, I forget your name earlier, point out what makes the movie so real when you came on, is that at the very end, she's holding a picture, not of Nick, but of her attendant in the insane asylum. She's fixating on him now, and it shows how quickly, like a real woman, how quickly their feelings can move to another man.
I'd say that's a distinctly non-tragic aspect of it. You know, she's done it before. She'll do it again. There are a lot of stories like this about women who basically go around from man to man killing them. I mean, it's something of a. It's almost a Jungian archetype.
Yeah, I would point out, too. I'm sorry I'm holding up the show, dragging it on. Did any of you guys see the movie Ex Machina that came out last year?
Nah.
Or the year before?
No.
Well, basically, spoiler alert, it's about this guy. He wins a prize with his boss, basically this fictional Google, and the guy's made a real AI, like the first life-size AI, humanoid AI. And the movie is about this female AI manipulating this guy emotionally, sexually.
Aww.
And at the end, she completely turns on him to escape. And she never meant any of her sexuality or feelings for this guy. She's clearly using him to escape. And feminists were freaking out about how dark that showed women.
Because it's true.
It's true.
I got a story from that too. Girls will do that. I've loved this one girl and she just did the same thing to me. Yeah, a lot of girls today are robots.
We are at the end of the show, but what do you think about doing another show in the future on Clueless?
Yeah, we should do it. Clueless.
Absolutely.
It's definitely a great idea.
Absolutely.
Great. Yeah, I had a bunch of thoughts on that show.
Well, it's been a great show. We've had a lot of interesting things to say about The Crush. If you haven't seen it, like, go check out the film. Check out The Crush. I'd like to thank Pilliter, Charles Lincoln, Craig Langley Jr., and Count Isidore Fosco for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert.
Always.